is what you get on most computers and with most colleagues. I'm Diana Boer, and our show is Communicate with Confidence. The idea is to provide you with insight, illustration, and ideas on how to improve your communication at both work and home. In this segment, we're going to talk about your body language and what your body language says about you, and how much we depend on it to get results or read between the lines when others talk to us. We communicate with our body language very loudly and very clearly, whether we're making a presentation, being interviewed for a job, or interviewing someone else, arguing our position by the water cooler, or trying to pick up a date for the evening. What people see as you stand, walk, move, or open your mouth reveals volumes about your personality, about your state of mind, about your confidence, about your competence. Let's talk about all of those issues in more detail. First, voice. What does your voice quality communicate about your personality? Well, your voice often suggests your personality in several ways. If you were participating in a corporate skit, how would you play the part of a complainer, for example? Whiny? Nasal voice? How would you play the part of a crook? Raspy? Maybe harsh tone? Or think about this. How would you play the part of an incompetent, nerdy kind of person? Maybe very high-pitched? Rapid? Maybe even quivering a little? It's tentative? How about the role of a sexy coquette? Breathy? Slow? Lilting? Or maybe an impatient tone? Fast? Full of emotion? See, all of those things being equal, all other things being equal, movie producers accept or reject actors based on how their appearance and their voice match a character they're going to role play. You may be typed for life by this impression that your voice creates. Occasionally, people ask if they can or if they should modify their voice to communicate a different attitude or a different mood or to get different results. And my response on that? Sure. Certainly you want to do that. In fact, lower your pitch if you want to sound more authoritative and credible. You know, we generally use musical terms to categorize people's voice. We say they're soprano, an alto, a tenor, a baritone, a bass. People with a high-pitched voice give the impression of being nervous or immature, lacking in confidence, or sometimes even they come across as emotional or hysterical. People with a low pitch sound confident and competent. And so you can modify your own voice once you become aware of what your pitch is. Voice coaches and books on this tell you exactly how to affect and practice this change. If you want to make it to the boardroom, typically or generally, you'll want to adopt this lower, hushed tones that are more often heard there. Another way you can change your voice. You can speak at a slower rate when you want to convey seriousness, authority, a thoughtful deliberation or decision. A slow rate of speech implies well-chosen words, and it underscores the importance of the message. The pace gives the listener time to contemplate what's being said and attach the appropriate significance to those comments. Now, there are reasons that you might want to speak faster. You'll want to speak at a faster rate to convey excitement or enthusiasm, energy, passion about an idea. A faster rate typically increases interest, and it demands attention from people who are in your audience. The pace makes listeners work hard at listening and translate what's being said, but it sometimes makes it difficult if you're giving complex information or jargon. They have to listen up to stay up. also want to pay attention to your volume. You'll use an appropriate volume in a way to accomplish the objective you have for that particular conversation or presentation. Loudness sometimes has become synonymous with vulgarity or unruliness. A soft volume sometimes comes across as shyness, nervousness, or sometimes even incompetence. So you want to stay away from those two extremes when you talk about volume. Certainly, you want to be heard. You want to avoid mannerisms and toys when you talk. I call it playing with props. You know, trying to talk with a pencil in your hand, a paper clip that you're flipping in the air, toothpick, gum in your mouth. All of those things make it very difficult to understand you. Those trinkets or those toys or props or mannerisms detract from an image of authority. When you laugh, laugh on purpose. Let it be a sign of interest and genuine amusement or happiness. People who are in control of their emotions seem to be more in control of their situation. So smile, but put your mind on it. Smile with your attitude as well as your mouth. For years, novelists have tried with mere words to convey false from true smiles. In some of my own novels, in fact, I've used statements such as, "Her smile rose and faded like a window shade," or "The smile was in her eyes." See, when you feel a smile, it shows in the rest of your face. The lines around the eyes, the pupils, the forehead, the cheeks. Likewise, when you're faking a smile, that shows too. You know, the timing just isn't right. The wrinkles don't follow. The eyes don't light up. You want to make sure that that smile is genuine and appropriate. You also want to be aware that that fake smile sometimes is seen on the first face of the other person. Take your cue from inappropriate timing. You know, genuine emotions and expressions are generally brief. The false ones last longer. Sometimes there's a mismatch in the words to that facial expression. They just don't seem to sync. Now, people often ask me, well, can you really attach meaning to someone's body language? And my response, of course. People make a living doing that in the courtroom. But first, before you try to interpret that other person's body language, do establish a baseline. You have to know what is their normal communication style before you can judge changes. Now, we've all read books and heard talks about what various gestures means. You know, folded arms across the chest indicate a closed, defensive attitude most of the time. Leaning forward generally means interest. Shrugged shoulders generally means indifference. Narrow eyes, set jaw, sometimes means defiance. Then a smile and nodding we generally take to mean agreement. But having said all of that, those are typical meanings for typical body language. But a few gestures convey meanings in and of themselves. And in other words, what I'm saying is they have to be interpreted in a cluster. The gestures and the attached meanings mentioned here generally hold true, but the real meaning of gesture comes only when you understand the context, when you know what someone's normal body language is. And then when they make a change, when they're saying some particular thing or listening to you, that change is what's meaningful. Just as in spoken messages, one boss is excellent on a performance appraisal, maybe another boss is satisfactory. So, likewise, interpreting nonverbal language accurately involves paying attention to both the variations and the standard habits for that particular person. For example, what I'm saying here, Mitch may always sit with his arms folded, always, whether he's bored, whether he's elated. So before you decide to risk much on reading a customer's or a committee's or a jury box or a team's body language, you want to establish what's normal for that person or what's normal for that group. Chat with them on a neutral subject and get a reading about what they're conveying with those body language movements and voice. And then you'll know when something comes up that's controversial because they'll begin to change that body language. One man's smile may be another person's belly laugh. And remind yourself that people may give false nonverbal cues. People who smile and laugh at your jokes may be bored to tears. People who look at you with a blank stare may be very interested, actually, in what you have to say.
Hey, you know, when you're talking, it's not just other people who hear you. You hear yourself, too. Every word matters.
Now, let's talk about movement a little bit. If I want to build authority and just generally present myself well, I need to pay attention to how I walk, sit, stand, and move around in general. Now, I want to elaborate on those issues specifically. You walk, sit, stand with good posture. You may have noticed those various postures among people in the workplace. You know, there's the shuffler who shifts weight from one foot to the other, back and forth. They just never move anyplace. They're just dancing, so to speak. And then, of course, you have the pacer who walks and talks and walks and talks. We get the picture of a courtroom trial lawyer addressing the jury. And then you have the sprawler who tends to take up more than his fair space, his fair share of space, spreads out in a meeting, puts the briefcase over here, the jacket over there. It's just sprawled everywhere. Or you have the tired, you know, the person who sits or stands as if they hardly have the energy to hold themselves up. Good posture, on the other hand, conveys self-confidence and competence. Your control of a group or a situation can be won or lost by that image that you present as you stand, walk, or sit. Now, another thing in movement and space and demeanor is keeping appropriate distance. Edward Hall has done extensive research on proper distances among cultures. Patting someone on the back, letting a friend cry on your shoulder, reading a report over somebody's shoulder while they're sitting at the computer. Those represent very intimate distances. That's touching range. Now, personal distance from, let's say, 1 to 4 feet, that's appropriate for most conversations. You don't want to be overheard in such a conversation. You want to share an issue or problem in confidence. That's a personal distance, 1 to 4 feet. And then there's social distance. That's about 4 to 12 feet. And that's most comfortable when you're conversing with others if you don't mind that everybody around you overhears you. You typically keep that kind of distance at a cocktail party, maybe in a sales presentation to a group of customers around a conference table. And then there's public distance. That's generally further than 12 feet. That's maybe when you're telling your children, don't shout, he'll come over here. You can talk to him when he walks over here. It's just a little bit too far to have a conversation. Now, we use public distance sometimes to establish formality and to control a group. For example, if you're speaking before a group, sometimes you back away to create more distance or authority. That's generally not a good idea when you're giving a presentation. Just understand the effect that distance has, that public distance. Conversing from the correct distance makes the difference in how you control, what authority you have, and what kind of connection or rapport that you build. That's why speakers who want to maintain authority step up on a podium away from the individuals in front of a big, large group. But when they want to build trust with a group, maybe it's a customer, a boss, a group of peers in a project that they want to gain their buy-in, when they want to establish that kind of trust, they establish it with an easy, open, informal dialogue, and they move closer to the group. They stand very near. Generally, the closer, the stronger the rapport. So, space is no less important for you when you're communicating one-on-one, especially when communicating with those of another culture or the opposite gender or another age group. So, for example, when women tend to sit next to people they like, they sit a little closer. Men tend to sit facing people they like. Have you ever noticed that if a woman wants more space, they tend to put things like coats, briefcase, papers in the seat beside them to prevent others from sitting next to them in a meeting? when men have the same intentions, they block the seat in front of them or behind them. Children and older people prefer to sit and stand closer to others than people of the middle age. Extroverts stand and sit closer to others. Introverts tend to stand and shy away. Again, you're revealing a lot of things about your personality. You're sending a strong message with all of those things about moving and sitting and standing and placement of your personal items. So awareness of those differences prevents you from making others feel as if they're either being invaded, or they're being ignored. People tend to trespass in our territory in one of three ways. They either clutter our space with their things, or they use and seem to take over what's ours, or they step inside our little personal bubble of space.
Subscribe to a better life every day, only on the Success Training Network.
You show interest by moving closer to the other person or standing up. Notice that in a conversation, when someone gets really interested in an idea, they tend to lean forward. They tend to talk faster. They gesture more. They even stand and move closer to the other person. If the other person backs up, the pursuer sometimes doesn't even notice. Instead, he or she keeps leaning or walking forward. So if your intention is to generate enthusiasm, go with that natural inclination to move forward. But just be aware of that negative reaction, that pulling back. That is a big clue that you've violated their space. You also want to think about how you use touch and use touch appropriately. I'm talking about pats, squeezes, brushes, hugs. They all happen in today's workplace. We touch to show friendliness, empathy, consolation, excitement or commitment or sincerity or goodwill, hostility, all of those. Now, if you think people recoil or pull back at your touch, or if you feel hesitant to touch others when the occasion really calls for it, ask a trusted friend to help you sort through that confusion. One thing I want to give you about a no-no, and that is, don't point your finger. People often associate this gesture with an authoritative, dictatorial style. The scolding maybe of a parent or a teacher or a boss, I told you so. Most people are really turned off about that, with that wagging finger in the face. So instead, if you need to point to something, use your whole hand or your fist, but not that finger that comes across like, I told you so. Tell your body what mood you're supposed to be in, and that way your body language will sync up. When a person feels sexy or romantic, the voice takes on a different pitch. The breathing rate changes, the eyes flirt, gestures and movement become more fluid. When a person feels like they should just be laid back, informal, their voice seems to yawn. It just sounds like it has no energy. The eyes kind of dim. The movements become more haphazard. All that coordination between your mind and your mood and your body is fine. Unless the mood is inappropriate for the time, the place, the person, or the relationship. And then there's eye contact. Let's talk about eye contact for a moment. What about eye contact? Well, some people seem aggressive, and some then are very passive because of the lack of eye contact. So what about some do's and don'ts here? Well, first, you want to respect status with your eye contact. The person with more authority has the privilege or the responsibility of either making or breaking eye contact. If you continue to stare belligerently after someone has broken that eye contact and they've moved on and they've dismissed you, and you continue to stare, your behavior often is considered defiant or rude. So you want to use eye contact instead to build rapport with others, not generate aggression. Locking eyes with another individual can say to that person that you're interested in them, that you think they're important, that you believe in what they're saying, that you believe it's important that they hear what you're saying. On the other hand, when you withhold eye contact, you're saying to that other person, I don't think you're worth getting to know. Or I don't think what you have to say is all that interesting. Or it could mean, I think you're lying. Or what you're saying has absolutely no consequence or value to me. Eye contact is so powerful in our culture that we even summon a waitress or a taxi driver by just, quote, catching their eye. We reprimand a child sometimes with a grimace. We show love by gazing into the other person's eye. Your eye contact can be the most powerful tool you have for building rapport, or your most dangerous weapon in destroying relationships. So use eye contact to build rapport with others. Lock eyes with another individual. That can say to them that you're interested in them, that you think they're important, that you believe what they're saying, that you believe it's important to hear what they're saying. On the other hand, to withhold is almost a punishment in our culture. So, to wrap up about body language, we've been talking about volume and voice and what it communicates about your personality, your mindset, your competence. We've talked about movement and space and distance. I hope you picked up some points about reading others, your spouse, your customer, your cousins, your kids. Just remember, you can't not communicate, even with your mouth shut. This is Diana Boer, hoping you'll communicate with confidence.